Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight to the Gallipoli Club for our discussion on Australian multiculturalism, success or not. And we have three well-qualified speakers here tonight, and I'll introduce them in the order in which they're speaking. Dr. Sev Ostowski, Director, Equity and Diversity, Western Sydney University, and Adjunct Professor, Centre of Peace and Conflict Studies at the University of Sydney. Parnell McGuinness, Communications Consultant and Writer. And Tim Soo-Pomasan, Race Discrimination Commissioner. And I think all three are making their first appearance at the Sydney Institute, and all are very welcome. So each speaker will speak for about 15 minutes, and then we'll take questions and discussion and finish when we finish, but certainly before the top of the hour. So we lead off with Sev. Thanks.
Welcome, everyone. It's really good to see you here. I know it's a bit earlier, but we are here. Thanks also to the Sydney Institute for the invitation to Anne and Gerard. It's a pleasure to be here. By now, possibly you wonder what's my accent. I was born in Poland a long time ago, and in 73, my wife and I, we ran away. We didn't like the system. We spent 2 years in Germany, and we came to Australia as migrants. When decided where to go, because there was a number of opportunities, we certainly were looking for a new country. Staying in Europe wasn't an option. It was extremely difficult to join European societies. It was taking 2-3 generations to become local. Then we were looking for stable democracy. We didn't like very much communism and what was happening in Poland. And somehow we also wanted to go to a country with British democracy. Argentina, for example, was offering settlement at that stage. We didn't think so. And perhaps I should declare my bias. Part of the problem we chose Australia, it was multiculturalism. It was a very new policy at that stage, just emerging. We heard of it and we thought at least we will get a fair go. What I would like to do is to spend my 15 minutes just to talk a bit about history and key concepts associated with multiculturalism. Basically, the post-Second World War migration delivered Australia cultural diversity, which became one of the most defining contemporary characteristics of this country. And this large intake of migrants, and really I'm talking about close to 1% of Australian population since about 47, and Germany just now have got a bit over 1% and it's panicking. We've been doing it for a number of years and we are doing very well. What's interesting is that government had to do something to respond to that diversity. And at the beginning, there was that idea that we can assimilate non-British migrants, that they will melt seamlessly into Australian society, that they became local patriots, forget about their cultural baggage, and marry local girls. It didn't work that way, and it didn't work because non-British migrants, when they arrived in Australia, didn't melt that easily into Anglo-Celtic pot, but established their own lively communities. Partly it was associated with the fact that welfare system at that stage wasn't that great, and you had to have a community to support you. So they established their own churches, their own schools, welfare, financial institutions, and they also developed quite effective leaderships and ethnic media. The 60s saw the slow move away from policy of assimilation toward multiculturalism. The bottom line was that the concentration in certain localities of migrants was that significant that it was starting to make electoral difference. And I think this very clearly points to political dimension of multiculturalism, which was with us for quite considerable period of time. Also, assimilation was losing high moral ground, and there was emerging support among the Anglo-Celtic majority as well. Yes, the intermarriage took place and the ethnic food started to be left. So in early 70s, we decided that it's better to not to fight the cultures, but to try to join them together. And since then, successive national governments created architecture, policies, programs to acknowledge and support cultural diversity. Basically, if you look at all post-75 governments, with the exception of Karen, but Karen is having still some time, all of the governments issued major multicultural statements. Most of the state issued multicultural acts. There was no act on federal level, but basically architecture is in place, which very well could be reflected in an act, and enactment wouldn't make any difference. Now, what this multiculturalism is about? Yeah? There is no agreement on definition. If you take it literally, it means many cultures. Allow me to distinguish for you at least four different meanings which are being used in our society. First, it's a normative ideal how the diverse society should be organized to handle its cultural and religious diversity. And Australia adopted a model of multiculturalism where migrants can belong to Australia while keeping their original culture and traditions. The migrant heritage is welcomed and accepted, and their economic and civic contributions are cherished. There is, however, much less clarity in the definition when we are coming to the existing Australian culture. The majority view would say that multiculturalism has at its core some common elements of the established culture, for example, the rule of law, parliamentary democracy, civil liberties, freedoms, equality of sexes, and English as a national language, and that non-dominant cultures are seen as contributors rather than pollutants. There is, however, also a minority view which would argue that the ideal of multiculturalism implies that all cultures are equal, as the prefix multi implies equal parts. It would follow that all cultural beliefs and activities have equal standing and must be at least tolerated and preferably respected. For example, if a culture requires that a woman's status in the society is different from that of a man, this should be respected by the authorities and broader society. An occasion it may override the provisions of the Sex Discrimination Act. This view represents very much a relativist view of culture, where a range of different standards could coexist on equal footing. For example, the Sharia law could coexist with Australian laws. Opponents of multiculturalism quite often focus on that model and say that it's synonymous with tribalism and likely to undermine social cohesion. Personally, I'm having also a bit of a problem with the word, with the ending ism. To me, it's too close to fascism, communism, atheism. It's a bit too ideological. But on the other hand, the word is well accepted in Australia, and I'm not proposing to move away from it. Second, the multiculturalism is also used as a demographic descriptor of diverse population, and Australia is clearly a very diverse population. In some countries, some other countries, especially in Europe, this word is used only to indicate the presence of minority and not as a whole society concept. Third meaning of that word, it's simply a set of government policies and programs developed in the response to multicultural, to diversity, and to manage that diversity. And it includes a whole range of institutions. For example, it could mean policies aiming at social integration, anti-discrimination laws, welfare, language training for new migrants, or measures to combat the radicalization of Muslim youth. Fourth, it's multiculturalism is understood as a social compact or agreement, how we arrange our social, political, economic relations between different strata. And I will talk about it a bit more. But looking at our diversity, we clearly are extremely diverse society. There is over a quarter, 26% of us, who are born overseas, and further one-fifth or 20% of those who have at least one overseas-born parent. When you look at the intake, it's changing. Earlier, we had migrants mainly from Europe. In 2010-11, China overtook UK. Between 96 and 2013, Australia's overseas population grew by 51% and included close to 500,000 of people born in China and 370,000 of people born in India. When you look at the census from 2011, it reports 300 different ancestries and 200 different languages. When you look at Sydney, for example, 40% of households are using different language, the English at the dinner conversations, and in some suburbs this concentration is much higher. There's also enormous religious diversity, and let's not forget that there is this core which constitutes 61% of people who report Christianity, but there is certainly growing inclusion of Islam, Buddhism, and Hinduism into our society. When you look fast at the different programs, how they develop, and I will race through it, and if you'd like to have a more detail, have a look at my paper, which will be on the Institute's website. It really started with Whitlam or Grassby. At the beginning, it was total confusion. Grassby was talking about family of nation. He just brought multicultural theme from Canada. His achievement was the racial discrimination bill. When you look at Fraser, it was very different. He really well-defined multiculturalism, and he offered a whole range of ethno-specific services to look after different groups. It didn't come for free because he changed the taxation system, so Australians with family overseas couldn't have tax deductibility on money going overseas. It's what England is doing now to people who settled recently. Then, looking at labor at the beginning, they didn't like very much what Fraser did, so they started dismantling various organizations till they said, let's get rid of SBS, and then there were demonstrations, and Hawke totally changed and put multiculturalism into the core of his policies with establishment of the Office of Multicultural Affairs and development of the National Agenda for Multicultural Australia. And I think it is possibly the most significant document in all a range of documents produced by various governments. Under Joe Howard, in opposition, he wasn't very much pro-multiculturalism. Then, when he was elected, he got rid of the Office of Multicultural Affairs. But at the same time, also Pauline Hanson emerged with her strong anti-multicultural platform. Howard didn't wait very long, despite what being said. He was elected in March, but in December the same year, he came with a strong statement that Howard's views won't be tolerated. And when you look at later decisions of Howard government, in 1999, he issued a new agenda for multicultural Australia, and his hands on multiculturalism really came very strongly after New York September 11 attacks in 2001. At that stage, he started focusing on social cohesion, he started focusing on different ethnic groups and started talking to people. With Rudd and Gillard, well, Rudd promised the re-establishment of the office, did nothing. Later, Julia Gillard recovered multiculturalism. Of course, it was much more dressed in social justice and equality things. And I think it was the speech at this institute by Mr. Bowen who discovered the miracle of multiculturalism. Let's look now at the issue of what do we think about how it works. When you look at all public opinion surveys, multiculturalism is extremely popular. And I'm talking about 86% of Australians who like multiculturalism. When you go to younger generation, it's much more of them. When you look at whole range of other indicators dealing with social cohesion, like education, intermarriage, economic participation, civic and political participation, clearly multiculturalism well. It is not to put under carpet that there are some difficulties, and the difficulties mainly relates to geographical concentration and isolation of some groups, feeling of injustice in some groups, which is not necessarily very well justified, radicalization of small numbers in Muslim communities, and of course race discrimination, which possibly the commissioner will talk about it much more. But to conclude, I really believe that this compact which we entered in this society worked very well, that multiculturalism works well, much better than in any other country, that we, in a way, don't have too much choice, but continue with these policies. Possibly we need to continue explaining a bit more that it's around core Australian values, that it's not not free for all, but I believe that it is delivering not only social cohesion, but also it unlocks migrants' capacity and willingness to contribute to the society. Thank you.
We go to Parnell McGuinness.
Well, it's hard to follow a really successful migrant who loves multiculturalism, but I'm going to venture and say that multiculturalism isn't a success in Australia. We've got a very successful model of multiracialism, which we often refer to as multiculturalism, but as Sev said, there's no hard and fast definition of the term. So to sum, it means a society in which all cultures are valued equally, which is, as he said, a very poorly thought through concept. But Australian policymakers, luckily for us, have nudged it towards a meaning that suits them better. So the Department of Immigration uses it to mean diversity under a Leitkultur. So tonight I'll argue that if multiculturalism is a comparative success in Australia, it's due to the latter definition, but insofar as it's not a success, it's due to the former. So I just want to talk a little bit about the concept of the Leitkultur. Bassem Tibi proposed that Western values should form the Leitkultur or lead culture in Europe. By Western values, he meant human rights, secularism, civil society, the fruits of the Enlightenment. He emphasised that the importance of upholding these values in the face of multicultural relativism, as he called it, was incapable of resisting the influx of undemocratic and fundamentalist forces. In Germany, where his book was first published, this notion was pilloried by many and became associated with nationalism and anti-immigration sentiment. But in Australia, policymakers have embraced the Leitkultur concept, though it's not expressed in so many words. Australia has a great Leitkultur. We're peaceful, tolerant, democratic. We're also very egalitarian. And our good qualities and the prosperous and free society which they've engendered are also the reason why new immigrants continue to seek us out. Partly, Australian immigration policy and literature is based around upholding the like culture concept. But like Europe, we suffer the guilt of our imperfect origins in defending the values that make us what we are today. Instead, we often need to be told by others that what we have is worth fighting for. It's striking that immigrants are often the first to wring their hands over new waves of immigration, especially from their cultures of origin. They often fear that what they've left behind will follow them to the better place they've arrived at. And of course, Tibby himself is a Syrian-born immigrant to Germany, and one of the many immigrants who are despairing over Angela Merkel's open-door policy. Of course, simply defining a Leitkultur is of no use unless it's somehow enforced and upheld. Selective immigration is generally considered key to the success of Australia's multicultural experience. In his 2010 book, Germany Abolishing Itself, German politician Thilo Sarrazin proposes that a delay on immigrants accessing social security also has a key role to play. I propose that there are a third and fourth reason for the success of multiracial coexistence in Australia: difficulty and a high bar of expectation. The four key pillars of Australia's immigration success, as I see it, are firstly, selective immigration. Australia has practiced selective immigration since the 1830s, when skilled tradesmen and wealthy individuals were targeted by the immigration scheme. We continue to do so, selecting immigrants who are of working age, possess skills required in the Australian economy, speak adequate English, and profess at least to share our values. Immigrants with good communication skills and economic prospects are naturally much more likely to thrive in their new country. So the contribution of selective immigration to the success of a multiracial society is clear. Secondly, social security. Australia's rules around access to social security are more generous than some others, for instance, the USA. Nonetheless, there's a 2-year minimum wait before a new immigrant can receive social security from the Australian government. Contrast this with Germany, where, as Sarrazin says, anyone who can enter and achieve a legal status can receive an income without working that far exceeds what he has earned in his country of origin. Sarrazin says immigrants to Germany are provided for regardless of their own capacity or willingness to work. And he goes on to point out, in the USA, where it takes 5 years to qualify for benefits, 77% of immigrants feel that they're comfortable or part of the community in under 5 years of arriving, with only 5% saying they never felt at home. By contrast, 58% of immigrants of Turkish descent in Germany said that they don't feel welcome, and yet they continue to come. And 78% said that they don't feel that Angela Merkel is their leader. Sarrazin draws the conclusion that only those immigrants who believe that they can achieve something move to the USA or Canada or Australia. And those that then succeed in integrating themselves and making a go of it, at whatever social level, feel pride and gratitude to the society that's given them that opportunity. Thirdly, the difficulty factor. We value what we earn. While both of these former arguments are persuasive, I'm struck by the readiness with which people who would usually distrust the omniscience of bureaucrats accept that they're able to see into the hearts and minds of strangers from another culture. I therefore suggest that the real reason for the effectiveness of the selective immigration rests heavily on the second factor of effort and achievement. The truism that we don't value what we don't have to work hard for offers a clue to the effectiveness of the immigration criteria. Navigating layers of bureaucracy, subjecting yourself to skills and character tests, are a psychological investment which causes people to feel from the outset that they've obtained something worth having. Fourthly, a higher bar on behaviour. It's often considered taboo, but it's relevant to mention the behavioural bar on immigrants. The Australian government made a great show last year of revoking the visas of non-citizen immigrants who'd broken the law, including New Zealanders. It seemed harsh to Australians, but the message arrived at its intended audience, the non-citizen population of Australia, loud and clear. That it said, you're here on sufferance, you'd better behave. Now in Germany, the bar was much lower until just a few months ago. Before the new year sex attacks in Cologne, The law in Germany was that legal immigrants could not be deported unless they were sentenced to a crime carrying a sentence of greater than 3 years. Combined with Germany's sentencing doctrine, which prefers non-custodial remediation over incarceration, the bar for deportation was very high, and hence the bar for behaviour, potentially low. So, does that mean that Australia's version of multiculturalism is an unmitigated success? Well, despite the strength of the Australian model of multiculturalism under a Leitkultur, the Australian experience hasn't been unequivocally positive. We've not entirely avoided cultural ghettos and welfare dependency. And the reason for this is that the separatism championed by multiculturalists under multiculturalism, rather than the reality of multiple ethnicities, has often exacerbated these issues. Immigrant, another immigrant, and intellectual, Frank Knopfenmacher, a Jewish refugee of the Holocaust, thundered against those who favoured the fragmentation of the political and cultural unity of Australia's Anglomorph culture into diverse groupings based on ethnicity in the name of multiculturalism. The practical alternatives to assimilation, he believed, are ghettoisation, apartheid, with all its attendant misfortunes, of ethnically fixed systems of disprivilege. And just to be clear, because those who argue in favour of assimilation are often accused of it, Knopfelmacher was no racist. He believed that the best, and indeed the only way of overcoming non-Anglomorph ethnocentrism is by a liberal policy of absolutely open access to all levels of Australian society. Knopfelmacher deplored the multicultural gimmicks which may accentuate and over-dramatise otherness, actually hindering politically effective but financially much more expensive ways of improving an ethnic's lot, such as the provision of appropriate education for high achievement. Where Knopfelmacher got it wrong, of course, is that we managed to find much more expensive ways of achieving the same poor outcomes. But while Knopfelmacher's fears that multiculturalism would be a cheap gimmick were unfounded, his concern that it might accentuate and over-dramatise otherness have been vindicated. The celebration of a separatist vision of multiculturalism has put one section of Australia on a direct collision course with the Leitkultur concept, which Australia's multiracial success is based on. Germany, in rejecting that concept, has suffered. Bassem Tibi denies that his Leitkultur thesis was based on the German experience and insists that this is an argument for all of Europe. But the problem of Turkish ghettos in Germany arising from a deliberate choice not to assimilate the guest workers brought in to rebuild Germany after World War II is a case study in the failure of separatist multiculturalism. Here an underclass has developed of an ethnic group functionally illiterate in two languages and entirely unable to help themselves out of the trap which the cultural relativists and welfare generosity have lowered them. This is truly an example of Martin Luther King's soft bigotry of low expectations and is echoed across the banlieue of France and Belgium. Assimilation would have had better outcomes. As the example of Europe makes clear, big picture values alignment is essential to the success of a social grouping. Diversity of experience and perspective within a group is enriching, but dogmatic preservation of parallel cultures is unconstructive. Interestingly, business gets it. For the same amount of time that multiculturalism has been used to justify cultural separatism, business has been developing a theory of cultural fit. Recently, perhaps in the face of globalisation, the theory has become intensely fashionable. And the arguments in favour of cultural fit in the workplace would horrify many if they were expressed by a politician. And yet, precisely because they've been developing and articulating the theory well away from the pious and poisonous battlefields of the culture wars, they shine a useful light on the issue. A recent article on HBR.org, online publishing platform of the Harvard Business Review, described cultural fit as the likelihood that someone will reflect and or be able to adapt to the core beliefs, attitudes and behaviours that make up your organisation. The author points to a 2005 analysis which revealed that employees who fit well within their organisation, co-workers and supervisor, had greater job satisfaction, were more likely to remain within their organisation and showed superior job performance. The author addresses a common criticism of cultural fit as well, that it can lead to discrimination against candidates and a lack of diversity, arguing that hiring for key organisational values does not exclude candidates of diverse backgrounds. That is, not only people who come from one particular background or have one particular set of experiences will hold certain values. The article concludes that if you hire for cultural fit, you will hire professionals who will flourish in their new roles and drive long-term growth and success for your organisation. It's important to note that hiring for cultural fit is as much about the success and happiness of the individual as the success and growth of the organisation. So let's transpose this argument onto the multiculturalism debate, and you have the clearest non-ideological argument you will hear in favour of recruiting only immigrants who will subscribe to the Leitkultur, regardless of the diversity of their background, the colour of their skin or the religion they practice, and mostly for the happiness of them as well as the society they're entering. A successful immigration nation needs to be sure enough of its own values to define a Leitkultur which immigrants are expected to subscribe to. Australia's multicultural success is based around the idea that the rights and opportunities extended to immigrants of all kinds are coupled with responsibilities. As Germany's contrasting experience shows, lowering the bar of expectations set for immigrants does not increase their gratitude to the host country and the satisfaction they find living in it, but lowers it. We, in turn, as a wealthy and safe country, have a responsibility to both humanitarian and economic refugees. Paramount to this responsibility is preserving the Leitkultur, which offers protection against persecution, tolerance, and the opportunity of prosperity. The better we do on this front, the more refugees of all kinds will be able to offer safe haven and opportunity in a prosperous Australia. The ideology of multiculturalism is a failure because it works against this goal.
Dr. Tim Suthpommasan. Suthpommasan.
Thanks very much, Jared, and a pleasure to be here at the Sydney Institute. I want to extend my thanks to Jared and Anne Henderson for having tonight's forum. I'd like to make the case for why multiculturalism is successful, and I do so by drawing attention to the distinctive qualities of the multicultural experience here in Australia. But let's begin by looking at multiculturalism as a social reality, or what Sev referred to earlier as the demographic features of multiculturalism. Very simply, we live multiculturalism every day. We live it in our cities, in our suburbs, in our schools, our workplaces. We see it on our buses and on our trains. And for the most part, people are very comfortable with this reality. As Sev mentioned, surveys have shown high public acceptance of multiculturalism. The 2015 Mapping Social Cohesion Survey, for example, found that 86% of Australians agree that multiculturalism has been good for the country. And it's a level of agreement that has been consistent for the past 3 years. True, this acceptance is accompanied by debate, but in any debate, it's important that we recognise what Australian multiculturalism in fact involves, because our experience has been fundamentally different from those in other parts of the world. While it's true that multiculturalism in many liberal democracies is in a troubled state, I don't believe this is the case for Australia. Ours, and the facts, I believe, back this, is a success story, not a failure. As Parnell's remarks highlight, the debates about multiculturalism here quite frequently track events overseas. And during the past decade, we've seen a consensus emerge in Europe. Governments in Germany, France, Britain, the Netherlands, to name but a few, have sounded a retreat from a policy of multiculturalism. And some would argue that a similar retreat should occur here. That's certainly how I'd interpret Parnell's remarks. Critics of multiculturalism argue that it promotes more division than unity, that it may prevent groups from being integrated into a common national culture and identity. Now, I think these reflect legitimate concerns, because cultural diversity cannot be welcomed without some limits. And public policy should aim to bring people in to a national community rather than preventing them from doing so. In the European context, there are clear indications that many immigrant groups are not integrating into national communities as they should. It's manifest through experiences such as residential segregation of ethnic groups, the poor acquisition of language, the educational and employment outcomes of those from migrant backgrounds. Now, if Australian multiculturalism were indeed to be considered a failure, then we should see such signs of trouble revealing themselves here. The evidence, however, doesn't appear to suggest that this is the case. Now, let's take social cohesion. Even multiculturalism's critics would concede that there has been a social miracle of migration in Australia in the 20th and 21st century. Again, we turn to the social cohesion research done by the Scanlon Foundation, and we find that there is a large measure of social cohesion across the country, including at the level of our neighbourhoods. Last year, for example, only 2% of people surveyed strongly disagreed that people of different backgrounds get on well together in their local area. Only 3% strongly disagreed that the mix of different backgrounds improved life in their local area. Let's look at another measure. Let's look at educational attainment. Studies from the OECD clearly demonstrate that the children of immigrants in Australia attain better average results than the children of native-born Australians. Such performance is mirrored in economic performance. Skilled migrants have a higher labour market participation rate than the overall population. Their median annual earnings is also higher on average. Let's then consider civic integration. Parnell highlighted some of the issues in Europe around this, the fact that there are children of migrants who don't identify with their home society. Well, here in Australia, an estimated 80% of immigrants with more than 10 years of residence indicate that 80% of those have chosen to take up Australian citizenship. It's a very high rate of take-up when it comes to citizenship. It's not a case in Australia of immigrants, therefore, remaining foreigners. Those who arrive here clearly want to become full members of the Australian nation. And I'll speak to this from my own personal experience. I, like Sev, am a migrant to this country, and I came here as a 3-year-old child with my family. But I can tell you that growing up, there was no prouder moment for my family than the day that we became Australian citizens. And my parents taught me growing up that I was an Australian and I should always consider myself an Australian citizenship. I would say to you that this is a sentiment that many migrant families would be inculcating in their children, in their homes, at the dinner table. So, on all these counts that I've gone through, social cohesion, educational attainment, economic participation, civic integration, Australia's multicultural society has been a success. Unfortunately, it's something that's missed by some commentators who turn to Europe and draw the wrong conclusions for our country. It's akin to looking at a Peugeot or an Audi, seeing a design flaw in those cars, and concluding that a Holden, therefore, will carry the same flaws. It doesn't work. Now, Australia's multicultural success has been predicated on Australian society accepting immigration as a nation-building project. In many countries, this hasn't been the case. Immigration occurred without planning, but that wasn't the case here. And a well-ordered immigration program has ensured public acceptance of cultural diversity. It has underpinned the natural cultural generosity of Australian society. Another reason for success, though, is that we've had a very particular model of multiculturalism. There are important differences between what Europeans would call multiculturalism and what we here have called multiculturalism, particularly in policy. Seb's already touched on some of the history of multicultural policy, but it emerged indeed in the 1970s. It replaced the initial policy approach of assimilation that was adopted towards mass immigration from Europe in the immediate post-Second World War years. In the very simplest of terms, we can define multiculturalism as meaning the public endorsement and recognition of cultural diversity. It means that a national community defines its national identity not in ethnic or racial terms, but in terms that can include immigrants. It means a national community accepts that its common identity may evolve in time to reflect its composition. That's how I would define multicultural policy. Now, what's been called multiculturalism in France and Germany, to return to the comparative dimension here, does not accord with the policy of Australian multiculturalism. The French approach, for example, can be better described as a republican or assimilationist one. Because in France, if there are to be expressions of cultural difference, they are to be confined to the private sphere. They have no place in public. This explains the French bans on the wearing of religious symbols in public places, such as schools, or the wearing of face coverings, such as the burqa, in public. There's nothing that is multicultural about such bans or such an approach. The German approach, meanwhile, has been shaped by the guest worker model of immigration it adopted in the post-war years. Germany did accept immigrants into its labour market, but it never, for a long time, welcomed them as fellow members. Immigrants were tolerated as guest workers who were expected to return home once their work was done. It wasn't, for example, until the year 2000 that German nationality law was changed to allow those born in the country to parents without native ancestry to even claim German citizenship. Well, Australia has taken a different path. Unlike French republicanism, Australian multiculturalism has not confined difference to the private realm. We openly celebrate our cultural diversity. Now, just consider, for example, last month's public celebration of Lunar New Year or Chinese New Year. That kind of open public endorsement of diversity wouldn't have been contemplated in French republican society. If anything, it would have been regarded as fundamentally threatening to the civic order. And unlike the German approach, Australia has extended the hand of civic friendship to immigrants. Those who arrive on Australian shores as migrants aren't expected to remain mere guests. They're rather expected and encouraged to become fellow citizens. In this respect, Australian multiculturalism is indeed based on a compact of citizenship. Cultural differences are to be embraced, but only when they are consistent with living within an Australian democracy. And if you're in doubt, you only need to look at the citizenship pledge that naturalising migrants take when they become Australian citizens, the very pledge that my parents took in 1988 when they became citizens. I pledge my loyalty to Australia and its people, whose democratic beliefs I share, whose rights and liberties I respect, and whose laws I will uphold and obey. That's the pledge. And in those four clauses, we have writ the contract of citizenship in this country. So, when we have discussions about multiculturalism, it's simply inaccurate to say that in Australia we have sanctioned a form of cultural relativism. Any right to express one's cultural identity and heritage has always been accompanied by responsibilities. There must be certain commitments. There must be a commitment to liberal democratic values, to things like parliamentary democracy, the rule of law, freedom of speech, equality of the sexes. And that's because Australian multiculturalism has always been an exercise in nation building. As Craig Launday, the Assistant Minister for Multicultural Affairs, has said recently, I quote, "Our success as one of the most culturally diverse and socially cohesive nations in the world is firmly grounded in our adherence to the values which underpin Australian society." Let me turn now to two challenges that I see in sustaining our multicultural success. First, the civic and non-partisan character of multiculturalism must be defended. If the Australian public does have a broad acceptance of multiculturalism, as the evidence suggests, then it is because our model has avoided political sectarianism. Australian multiculturalism enjoys, and rightly enjoys, political endorsement from all the major political parties. Too often, however, there is missing a measured view of multicultural policy. Some on the progressive side of political debate see only rights and not responsibilities, while some on the conservative side of politics see only a recipe for cultural difference and not also one for political unity. Yet I would submit that in one respect, Australian multiculturalism in fact has an emphatic conservative spirit. It's something, after all, that is explicit about the sacrosanct nature of our parliamentary democracy and our rule of law. It says that we should affirm and protect our liberal democratic institutions. It says that we should endorse values of civility and respect. These are not radical ideas. These are deeply conservative ideas. A second challenge concerns the legal architecture of multiculturalism, namely the Racial Discrimination Act. An official multiculturalism would mean little if it were not supported by laws that guarantee equal opportunity in public life. Over the past 40 years, the Racial Discrimination Act has done this, and it is important that it continues to do so. There has, of course, been much debate recently about the Act, but I would say that there's been widespread misunderstanding about the Act's provisions, especially Section 18C, which makes it unlawful to offend, insult, humiliate, or intimidate someone because of their race. There continues to be commentary which suggests that Section 18C stifles free speech by capturing conduct that is merely offensive. Some recent commentary has also questioned Section 18C's constitutionality. Such commentary is misguided. Since it was introduced in 1995, Section 18C has been found by the courts only to apply when it causes serious and profound effects involving race. It does not cover acts which cause mere trivial slights or harms, and it remains rare for complaints about racial discrimination to reach the courts. For example, last financial year, 2014-15, the Australian Human Rights Commission finalised 405 complaints about racial discrimination. Less than 3% of those complaints ended up in court. The majority of complaints are in fact successfully conciliated by the Commission. In 2014-15, 67% of complaints were successfully conciliated. As for the constitutionality of Section 18C, well, the body of case law to date suggests that the law is settled on the issue, or relatively well settled. The Federal Court, in the case of Jones and Scully, has held that Section 18C reflects a domestic implementation of Australia's international legal obligations as a signatory to the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. The reasoning of Justice Healy in that case has been followed in all subsequent cases where the issue of constitutionality has been raised. Understanding how Section 18C works also requires attention to Section 18D of the Act, which explicitly protects freedom of speech. This section protects anything that's done reasonably and in good faith, that is artistic work, or fair reporting and comment on matters of public interest. Among many critics of the Act and among those calling for its review, there is a puzzling ignorance of Section 18D. And indeed, the courts have interpreted Section 18D very broadly. There have been numerous instances where acts causing racial offence have been found to enjoy the exemption of 18D. I'll give you very quickly the case of Brofo, which involved cartoons lampooning the return of the head of Yagan, Noongar, a warrior shot dead in 1833 and whose preserved head was displayed in a British museum. Despite the racial offence taken by Noongar communities in Western Australia, the cartoons in question were found by the Federal Court to have enjoyed the protection of 18D. If we're to endorse Australian multiculturalism, we should give it expression through the law. The law acts, among other things, to express our values as a society. And the Racial Discrimination Act continues to be an important statement about our commitment to civility and respect. And again, to return to my earlier point, I would say that civility and respect are values that should transcend political divides. We see in Australian multiculturalism and in the Racial Discrimination Act a spirit that could be described as fundamentally conservative. Conservatives, after all, have never shied from prescribing for society, as Edmund Burke did in his Reflections on the Revolution in France, the right kinds of sentiments, manners, and moral opinions. If I can quickly conclude on a third challenge. It's the challenge of extremism, and we've seen numerous examples during the past 2 years that there are elements present in our society intent on pursuing violent extremism using religious justifications. These elements simply have no place in Australian multiculturalism. But I do believe that we must take extreme care in not judging entire communities by the actions of an extremist few. We must not allow stereotypes and prejudices to take hold. For example, there is evidence which suggests that Muslim Australians experience a level of discrimination that is 3 times higher than the national average. Calling this out, identifying it as an issue, doesn't amount to encouraging a sense of victim mentality, as some commentators have suggested. We must be prepared to speak out against prejudice where it exists. Not speaking out can make it easier for extremists to seduce alienated youths with their messages of violence. And moreover, groups that target Muslim communities may not confine their energies just to that community. During the past 2 years, we've seen numerous instances of vile anti-Semitic bigotry, which appeared to be linked with far-right organised groups. The alarming rise of far-right politics in the US and Europe further highlights how liberal tolerance at the moment is being challenged by extreme nationalism. There are then a number of challenges for Australian multiculturalism, but I do believe we start from a position of strength. We have been a success, but there's no reason for us to be complacent. But debate, civil debate about these issues is always to be welcomed. And on that note, I thank the Sydney Institute for facilitating tonight's discussion.
Thanks to our three speakers, and thanks for everyone keeping in time. So we've got plenty of time for debate and discussion. I should say before we start off, Tim Soupomasan's recent books, we've got some copies of them. His book, Don't Go Back to Where You Came From, Why Multiculturalism Works, and his edited collection, I'm Not a Racist, But 40 Years of the Racial Discrimination Act, which contains his essay and some others. And so now I'm sure Tim would be happy to sign copies. We've got them for sale after. So I think if just the three of you come back here, I'll move away in a minute, and when anyone get a question, just come up and answer it through the microphone. So, Seb, why don't you go over there, and you two here, over there. Now, can I just, I'll just start off, I think if we direct a question to a specific person, and keep it fairly brief because we've got a lot of people here. But I grew up in the 50s and the 60s. I worked in the Fraser government when they established the Department of Multicultural Affairs. I've never quite worked out what it does, and I just wonder whether any of this stuff matters. I mean, the 50s and the 60s were highly successful periods when many people came in from Europe in the 50s and beginning in the 60s from Asia, settled pretty well, and everything seemed to be going pretty well before Gough Whitlam and Malcolm Fraser decided to bureaucratise all this. So I'm just wondering, what does the department do and does it matter? Seb, you should lead off on this.
Well, basically, the demographic reality changed. Migrants arrived, they organized themselves, they started to have some wealth, they started to have electoral influence. The parties decided to cater for that electoral influence, and the migrants wanted to have that their cultures are acknowledged, and parties agreed that it's possibly a good way of going ahead. Whitlam started with it. He basically didn't know very much what he was talking. He had some good intentions. No, it's a fact, yeah. And I spent many hours talking with Al Grasby about it. As a matter of fact, multiculturalism never became an official platform of Whitlam labor policies. But Fraser took it very systematically. And he decided, especially in context that we are taking quite a significant number, not of labor migrants, but of refugees from Lebanon and Vietnam, that we need to have ethno-specific services to look after them. And they were very different people. When we select migrants, we go for the best. you really need to meet very stringent criteria to be allowed to come to this country. When you are coming here as a refugee or humanitarian, you are coming because of situation you found yourself in, and you need plenty of support. Migrants do earn more than the Aussie-born people. They pay more taxes. They are much more in the labor market than locally born people. When it's coming to refugees, the story is very different. So basically, it's how it really started.
Does anyone want to add to that, or we just go on? No, okay. So where are we? Anne? Tim, why don't you come up here?
Anyway,
okay.
I'm a great supporter of multiculturalism. I've written about it. But it has failed on a couple of significant occasions. It failed with Pauline Hanson, and it's probably failed in most recent times with the settlement of many Middle Eastern migrants to Australia who have become linked to financial dangerous people. So is the problem that because we bend over backwards to say we want to be tolerant, we want to be diverse, and we bureaucratise it, as Jerry just said, the problem then comes when the locals feel that newcomers are being given more than they are? Can anyone comment on that?
Well, let's start with Tim, and and then we may go to...
Well, it's a question that reflects legitimate concerns about how we perform in integrating different migrant groups. I would say that with the experience of Pauline Hanson, you did have a backlash against multiculturalism and notions of political correctness, but Australian multiculturalism has recovered pretty well from what happened with Hansonism. I grew up through the years of Hansonism, and that's when I first began thinking about what it meant to be Australian. And I grew up thinking about those questions because the questions being asked of migration and multiculturalism were questions that affected me and my family. When Pauline Hanson said that we're being swamped by Asians, she was talking about families that looked like mine. And if she was saying that multiculturalism didn't work, then by implication she was saying that I had no place in Australian society either. But what we have seen is some positive change coming through since the 1990s. If you look at, for example, the suburb of Cabramatta here in Sydney, back in the 1990s, you would have pointed to Cabramatta as an example of why multiculturalism was failing, if that were indeed your view. You would say that that was an ethnic ghetto, crime was concentrated there, there was no integration. But today, 20 years later, Cabramatta is a tourist destination here in Sydney. If you pick up a brochure as a visitor to this city, Cabramatta is identified as a place to visit, as an attraction. That, to me, illustrates how resilient multiculturalism can be. Now, on the second example that you've highlighted, which is the problem of extremism, that is a real problem. Does that reflect a failure of multiculturalism? I don't believe that it does. What it reflects is a challenge. And we should be very clear that there's no room for violent extremism or for doctrines which advocate the overthrow of our liberal democracy. But I do believe that it is a problem that is confined to a minority of the population that adheres to the Islamic faith. It's my view that the vast majority of Muslim Australians reject and repudiate extremism and would see it as an affront to their participation in Australian society as well. That would be the caution I would add to debates about that issue.
Anil, do you want to make a comment?
Yeah, just very briefly. Look, I was really struck with all three of what we said, that essentially we're all saying the same thing with slight variations. We all think that multiracialism in Australia is a success. We're just basically differing slightly on how we express that and how much of that sort of ism there should be in it. So I think where we do have these problems, they come actually from the ism and the separatism that comes out of it. And what happens a lot of the time is that's how it gets away. People say, no, they can be left alone to carry out their own lives, to keep their women in any way they see fit. And that's when we end up with situations which flare up over time. It's highly unpleasant for you, Patrick, but in general, everybody would say it's good.
And what was the last point?
In general,
there was agreement, yeah.
Okay. Perhaps if I could add, I strongly agree with Tim that Pauline Hanson was a direct reaction of overreach of multiculturalism during the Hawke-Keating government. We went too far, too fast, people didn't follow, they didn't know what about it. Many people felt left behind and lost, and it's what happened. And in a way, therefore, the policies of Howard slowly moved to recover the ground. But it's a lesson for the future. Don't be too triumphant with some policies which people simply do not follow. Regarding the Lebanese, let's put it this way. Of course, terrorism is totally out, and in a way, perhaps I would argue that multiculturalism is very much helping to control it. When you compare our Lebanese people, either Muslim or Christian backgrounds, with those who settled in Europe, in Germany or France, our are having really about 3 times higher educational achievements. When you have, for example, only 20% of parents having the high school education, their children, almost all, do have a high education in Australia. In Europe, most of them are dropouts from school. When you look, for example, at Lebanese community, there were 2% of professionals when they came from refugee situation in Lebanon. Their children occupy about 20% of professional positions. I would argue that it's partly thanks to the multicultural policy, to opening our universities, to making it possible to welcoming people. I lived 2 years in Germany and I work with Turkish people in factories over there. They simply were not welcome to become Germans. Coming to Australia, you are welcome to join.
There's a question here. Yeah. Just come back, someone. Yeah. Yes.
My turn, is it?
Yep.
Okay, before I say anything, I'm also a product of multiculturalism. Been there in the community perspective for nearly 35 years. Administered the Anti-Discrimination Act and the Australian Immigration Law as in the tribunal. I started my career with Jeffrey Blaney coming up on the scene and also continued with Pauline Hanson. But I think that what he says is that in those days, the immigration department doesn't tell people what the policies are. It's not discussed in public.
Okay, we've got to be brief. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Now, after saying that under multiculturalism, I'm going to ask them, do you think ABC and SBS should merge?
Okay. So the question is, after a preamble, do you think the ABC and SBS should merge? Let's start with Tim. We'll go to Parnell. And
This is by no means a new question. This is a question that has emerged in various forms over the years, and we should have debates about the roles of our public broadcasters. My view is that SBS has played an important part in Australian multiculturalism. It has given voice to our multicultural society. And remember the original function of SBS. It was set up to help migrants understand how they could fit into Australian society, how they could take part, how things like Medicare, for example, worked. Earlier this week, I was at the launch of SBS's new Arabic radio station, a 24-hour service, which, among other things, is being targeted at the 12,000 refugees who will be coming from Syria on top of the regular refugee intake in the coming few years. So we see there an illustration of how SBS may be continuing to play that traditional role that it had. But should SBS and ABC merge? Well, that's a question, as with all questions, that is open to debate.
Anil, would you merge them or abolish both?
Of course you'd merge them. You can get everything that you can get from the SBS online now. They don't do a great deal of local service that the ABC doesn't do. What you would want to do, however, at the same time is also ease the regional restrictions on import of books and literature and now iPad or Kindle sort of downloads, because of course that's the way that you can give people access to the kinds of literature that they're currently not able to access in their own language.
Seb, you want to make a comment? Rodney. Yeah.
Question to Seb. You're associated with the peace studies at Sydney University. Everything I hear about this suggests a crude anti-Semitic organisation covering it up as pretending to be critical of Israel, which in itself is quite a successful multicultural society. For example, in Israel, there are Muslim judges on the Supreme Court in all the professions in Parliament, whatever. But returning to the point, the Department of Peace Studies harasses Jewish women on campus, tries to censor Jewish speakers visiting the university. What sort of multiculturalism is this?
No, I think he's talking about Professor Jack Lynch's department, but is that yours or?
No, I'm just an honorary professor over there. What does it involve that I give occasional lectures and I do supervise from time to time PhDs? I'm not responsible for running of the uni.
So it's the same department?
I'm in that particular department, yes. I work at the University of Western Sydney. Coming to the Jack Lynch's campaign against investment and so on in Israel, I disagree with it.
Okay. Right, so we've got a question here. Yep.
Yes, could I ask each of the three speakers as to your view, looking out over the next, say, 20 years, of social cohesion in our country? We've got extraordinary diversity today. Yet we've got that amazing statistic that each of you have quoted, that 86% of we Australians are very comfortable with our multiculturalism. So you've got two conflicting forces, diversity and cohesion. Could each of you speak to that, please?
So the question about the conflicting of diversity and cohesion and looking into the future.
They can conflict, but I don't see a necessary conflict. And let me explain why. When we say that we have a multicultural society, for me that proposition simply says that there's no one ethnic or racial way that you can be Australian. That you can be Australian, but also express your cultural identity and heritage and feel comfortable in your own skin, no matter what colour that skin may be. For me, for example, I see no contradiction in identifying as Australian, but also being very comfortable with my Lao and Chinese heritage. If we were to turn the clock back to the 1950s and 60s, there may well have been an expectation that I should not be proud of my Lao or Chinese heritage, that I should just be Australian and Australian alone, that no other identity mattered. And maybe I would have changed my last name from Supomasan to Southwood, and I'd be known as Tim Southwood, rather than going by the name Supomasan. And this was an experience that many European migrants would have had in the 50s and 60s. And so for me, that's the contrast I would draw between what a multicultural form of social cohesion can look like and what social cohesion in an assimilation model might look like.
So are you optimistic about the future?
Yes, cautiously.
He's optimistic. Parnell.
So 86% of Australians agree with multiculturalism and support it. Contrast that, though, with there are, I think, about 2% of Muslims in the population. Every time a survey like this is run, Australians estimate that at about 15%. There clearly is a bit of anxiety which is causing people to overestimate one single group. And I think the only way that you can deal with that is to say, well, why is it that they feel overrepresented in a way that's causing people anxiety? Is this something that we can bring within this value system? Because if we can't, then there will be problems with social cohesion. If we can, then there will. You know, just to add on the Turkish experience in Germany, over a very, very long period of time, they do eventually become really part of German society and start conforming to the norms. It takes about 3 decades because of the way that it's done badly there at the moment.
Yeah,
I will say a few words. Well, social cohesion, it's a very delicate flower. You're very careful what you do with it. I personally believe that we need much more leadership coming around the common values, around what expected, what needs to be done, what kind of a nation we need to be in the future. It includes anti-discrimination. Focus on equal opportunity is very important. Coming back to personal level, listen, if you'd like to be part of that great society, you need to feel self-confident. You need to feel proud. You need to pass your heritage to your children, and not heritage to your children that they go and use some other flags and demonstrate against the Australian government, but the language, so they understand the concept, so they can talk to you. You just can't take it away. If you do it, you will have much lesser cynicism and much more problems with social cohesion.
Jeff?
it seems to me we've got a more specific problem. It's all very well to say multiculturalism good, multicultural successful, but in fact the Islamic problem, or the Islamic situation, I think, we really need to deal with that squarely and honestly. Is the way in which Muslim women treated by their menfolk compatible with the general Australian values? Are there things in the Quranic beliefs which inhibit other Islamic people from criticising, why we don't get open discussion within the Islamic group about problems of Islam in Australia?
Okay.
So I think we need to face that
okay.
squarely.
So we've got a question about Islam in Australia, specifically about the treatment of Muslim women by Muslim men, and a suggestion that because of the activities in the community that some Muslims are afraid to speak out against others. I think that's right. So let's start with Tim, go to Parnell. Seb, if you all want to make a contribution.
There are some cultural practices which are simply incompatible with our liberal democracy. If there are doctrines and practices which lead to sexual discrimination, for example, then they should not be accepted. If, for example, people are conducting female genital mutilation and arguing that their culture requires it, that's not acceptable too. Recently, there was a ruling by the New South Wales Civil Tribunal concerning the New South Wales Anti-Discrimination Act, which had a finding against Hizbut Tahrir concerning their segregation of men and women in a university lecture. I welcome that finding. Those sorts of practices are not compatible with what I would regard as a liberal democratic multiculturalism.
So we're running out of time because there's a lot of questions here. So, Pano, do you want to make a comment on that?
I agree.
You're okay? You agree? Okay, so there's a question here, and then we're going down the back, and then we'll go here.
Question for the panel. What longitudinal studies have been done to validate what I would regard as the success of multiculturalism? Because it's now been going for at least two generations. And I suspect my own autobiographical experience is child of post-war migrants, spoke no English at home, completely integrated into this society. By the second generation, I look at my kids and their compatriots, and they're all Australians who just have interesting backgrounds. Now, what have we done longitudinally to validate the sort of experience?
Okay, so let's just give this to Seb. Are there any longitudinal studies that justify the multicultural policies?
Well, Scanlon studies we mentioned are going back to the 80s, and basically they are done every year, surveys, and they are all the time coming with quite strong support for multiculturalism, but they also indicating the disquiet to the Muslim communities. There is also a range of other studies, for example, educational achievement studies. The kids of migrants simply are doing much better in our schools than Australians. They do integrate, they move in. It's not like in France that they stay somewhere on the margin. If you look at the intermarriage, over 40% of Australian young people intermarry into different groups. It works. How it works, I can't explain it to you, but it works. And I just came back from Europe and I saw how entrenched attitudes are over there. And part of the reason I came to this country is because I could join here. I couldn't join in Germany or France or England. And I think possibly it is the secret.
Right down the back.
Just a quick observation about the anxiety around people's failure to assimilate. I come from an Irish Catholic family. An Irish Catholic family that has been in Australia since 1855. And all down the generations, until my generation, my children still go to a Catholic madrasa. It's Irish Catholic has married Irish Catholic. We were very, very slow to marry out, to engage with other communities. Yet I would sit around the table with my father, good old Santa Maria friend he was, while he whinged about all these various groups who refused to assimilate.
Well, the suggestion is... Okay. Well, hang on. We've got one speaker already. The suggestion is that Irish Catholics did not assimilate, I think. That's it?
That's my experience.
It's not my experience, but there you go.
I certainly assimilated to the Leitkultur.
Well, I'm not sure I've got a son-in-law who is Irish and, well, he intermarried, let's put it this way.
You referred to your father being a Bob Santamiramara. He was of Italian background, so. Okay, so there's a question here, then we go over here. Got to be brief. Yep.
Very quickly, would you not think, oh, well, my opinion is that the way forward to cross the hurdles of the polar opposites of multiculturalism works or it doesn't is to in fact have a rigorous debate on values, both on the values of diverse cultures against what we so sort of, you know, throw about as Australian values. But what the hell is it? Is it a static thing? It in fact is, you know, a set of values that's evolved. Can our politicians even articulate what Australian
values? There's a question about what Australian values may or may not be.
I think the reference point should be our civic culture and our liberal democracy. In terms of having debates about cultures, we should have debates, provided they're civil and informed. My view is that there should be a presumption that cultures are equal, but it's a rebuttable presumption. So if there's evidence which suggests that certain cultural practices are abhorrent, then we are right to judge cultural practices as abhorrent. But there should be a presumption and starting point that all cultures should be granted the benefit of being presumed equal.
So you put it down here, you still, no? Okay, over here, got to be quick, all right?
I think Parnell has raised some very interesting philosophical questions, and actually I've addressed this in my book on multiculturalism, but I actually had the honour, I suppose,
yeah, we've got to be brief,
of
so,
working okay. together with Dr. Noffel Marker. We were different political positions. The thing about that you raised, the philosophical questions about how we actually define multiculturalism, are very relevant. I would just ask you to think this way, though. I think you've offered a black and white picture. It seems to me that you can say that there are certain fundamental values which are fundamental to our multicultural society, and also those values can play a role in the way in which we accept some elements of other cultures. We don't have to accept the element of other cultures. We can also censor certain values of other cultures together and still have a multicultural society.
And the suggestion you've been into black and whiteism, is that?
Yes. Terrible. I went to some pains to try and avoid that, but it clearly didn't work. What I'm simply saying is diversity good, separatism bad. That's black and white. So, and the way that multiculturalism is used is sometimes on the good sense and sometimes on the bad sense, and we should be aware of the bad sense.
Now, since Frank Noffelmark has been cited quite a lot tonight, he was born in Czechoslovakia, went to Britain, came to Australia in the mid to late 1950s and became a senior lecturer in psychology at the University of Melbourne, where he became good friends of Anna myself. And it's great to know that all these years later, people are still talking about him. Final question, John Highfield.
Yeah. To Tim.
Tim, and now but we'll get others to comment on this
yes,
as well.
And
Tim.
Others to comment. Yep. You referred to the different models between integration, I suppose, of our incoming populations in Australia to that of Germany, particularly through the guest worker regime. Do you believe that if the 457 visa system is increased in Australia, that that could lead to a deterioration in Australia's view that people should be integrated into our society?
It's a live question. What we don't want to have is people who are permanently temporary. If temporary migrants arrive in Australia, participate in our society and want to be part of it, they should enjoy a pathway to becoming citizens. But it does reflect an evolution and development in the Australian migration system, which reflects the greater flow of people across borders today.
So just Tim, before we... 457 would have a limit of what? How many years? Someone coming out on a work contract, would it be 2 or 3 years?
Generally 2, 3, 4 years.
Okay, and then after that they go back to where they...
Or they apply for a different kind of visa, whether that's a permanent visa or a second temporary visa.
Well, so we're talking about immigration with respect to 457, yes.
Yeah, basically the only thing is we can't have a system which is unfair. 457s are quite often challenged by labour, and the issue is if we'd like to continue doing it. And it's a bit, in a way, of a system, try before you buy. You can stay 2 years and then ask for a different visa. If it's it is transparent, it is fair, it's okay. If we create political controversy about it, the net outcome would be we'll have to reduce our overall immigration intake.
Panel, do you want to make a comment on that?
The alternative to 457, to having 457 visas is not having them, and I think that that is vastly less preferable. It would essentially mean that people wouldn't come in unless they were planning to commit for a long, long time. So
I just want to ask a final question, to which we'll respond in the opposite order to which everyone spoke. If you're coming back here in 10 years' time, similar topic. We're starting with Tim. How much do you think the debate may have changed looking into the future only about a decade?
Well, then, this is a trap, Jared. One should be careful about predicting the future. I'm no seer. I would hope that in 10 years' time we'll be just as comfortable and relaxed about our multiculturalism, if not more. But it does require leadership, and it requires civil and reasoned debate.
Anil?
I agree. I don't think we'll have changed a great deal at all. We've got the settings right. Unless something happens and we go further into the separatist direction, I see 10 years' time being as good as today.
Tim?
I've got nothing else to add. Greener.
Well, thanks to our three speakers tonight, to Seb, to Parnell, and to Tim, for what was an interesting discussion across an important issue, with a range of views being presented and different historical perspectives. A broad agreement, but not a complete agreement, which is really the way the debate should go. So I'm very pleased to have had Sev Ozdevsky, Tim Supomasan, and Parnell McGuinness here tonight. As I said, there's some copies of Tim's book and there, and thanks for coming along. And I understand all our speakers have got fuller papers, so when Anne puts together the Sydney papers online, you'll get the longer version, but they cut down their speech and aren't fit within our time limits, for which we're very grateful. So well done to all three, and thanks for coming along.
Thanks, Jerry.
Well done, Tim. Thank you. Good.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.